Good afternoon, everyone. The meeting will come to order. The clerk will note the roll. We do not have a quorum at this point yet, and I'm not sure if we're going to get one, but we will at least unofficially convene the meeting. And I will, where the topic for the day, of course, is the budget forecast, and we welcome Commissioner France, Dr. Kolombakidis, and Budget Director Kelly. I don't know which of you wants to come first, but thanks, or talk first. Thanks for taking your time to be here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll unofficially kick off the team here. So as you know, we have the state economist, Laura Kolombakidis, with us, and State Budget Director Margaret Kelly. I'm just going to make a few opening remarks and get so you can get into the meat of the stuff, because I know you want to hear from them anyway. But just to say thank you to you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the members for coming together today to listen to us talk about the forecast that we released on Friday. And as you know, we forecast now a $1.4 billion balance for the 2018-2019 biennium. So one of the things that happens immediately is the reserve allocation happens immediately, and therefore we allocated $334 million to the budget reserve. So now we have a budget reserve a little over $1.9 billion. The target that's in the budget reserve is now about $2 billion, a little over $2 billion. So we're getting very close to the target that's been set for that reserve account. So after taking out the $334 million for the budget reserve, that leaves us with a balance of $678 million for the 16-17 biennium. And assuming that those funds are not used in 16-17 and are not spent but a carryover, then we would have $1.4 billion for a balance in 2018-2019. I just want to mention one risk, and then Professor Kolombakidis will talk about more. I'll just mention one risk, and that is the unusual thing that you've all experienced before, though, is this particular situation where we are forecasting in November for a biennium that hasn't even begun yet, and then the one after that. So we have literally 54 months in the future that we're talking about here, maybe a little bit longer, actually. So that is a risk in and of itself. A lot can happen in that length of time, as we all know, and there are a number of risks associated with that kind of looking out on the horizon. But with that, I'm going to turn it over to Professor Kolombakidis, who will walk through the economic forecast, and then you can have questions after Budget Director Kelly.
Dr. Kolombakidis, welcome back to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And for the record, I'm Laura Kolombakidis, Minnesota's state economist. I'm going to start by talking a bit about the outlook for the U.S. economy. Then I'll talk about Minnesota's economy and then the changes in our revenue forecast. So the first slide, you've seen versions of this many times. This shows the annual percentage change in U.S. real GDP growth, annual percentage change in U.S. real GDP, both the history and the forecast by IHS, which is Minnesota's macroeconomic consulting firm. The light bars show the prior forecast, so their February forecast, which informed our February forecast, and then the dark bars show the history and the November forecast. So the difference between the light and the dark bars is the forecast change, the change since February. I want to first point out, as many of you heard on Friday, that the IHS November outlook was released on November 7th and does not reflect possible post-election U.S. policy changes. There's considerable uncertainty in this forecast about which policy changes might be enacted in coming years and the impact of those changes. So what IHS is doing is that they are examining policy proposals that have been made or might be made by the president-elect and also trying to assess their probability of passing Congress. And as things clarify, they will add those policy changes and the potential economic impacts to their subsequent budget economic forecasts. So what I anticipate seeing is that every month with a new outlook from IHS, we'll see a little bit more clarity. But until that happens, the impact of potential policy changes on several key U.S. economic sectors, including energy, banking, international trade, healthcare, and immigration, remain sources of uncertainty in this forecast. So the outlook for U.S. economic growth has weakened since February of 2016. A reduction in business building and equipment investment during the first half of this year slowed economic growth for this year. And that reduction was partly due to slowing activity in the energy sector in response to low energy prices. The largest change occurs early in the forecast, 2016, where they had previously been anticipating 2.4% growth for this year, and now they're anticipating 1.5% growth. So 2016 has been a slow growth year for the U.S. economy. So you can see a pretty significant decrease in growth from 2.6% in 2015 to 1.5% in 16. IHS, or lower forecast for consumer spending and for business capital purchases, reduced the 2017 growth forecast from 2.8% in February to 2.2% in November. And the growth rates are lower throughout the rest of the forecast. Aside from policy uncertainty that I just mentioned, I want to highlight another source of risk in this forecast. So the current economic recovery and expansion period is mature. It is well into its eighth year. If U.S. growth continues until the middle of 2019, then this expansion will be the longest since the 1850s. So it will surpass the current record expansion of the 1990s. So then looking back at the chart, note that the outlook calls for economic growth to stay around 2.0% going forward. That is below the historic average for U.S. real GDP growth. So prior to the Great Recession, if you look at the 20 years prior to the Great Recession, the average annual real GDP growth in the United States was 3.1%. We have long anticipated getting into a slow growth era, but I just want to note that we're there. So slow growth in a mature expansion makes the economy more vulnerable to shocks. So it reduces its capacity to weather an unexpected event. On the next slide, we can talk about the primary reason for the change in forecast economic growth in 2017, and that was a reduced expectation for growth in consumer spending. IHS lowered their forecast for 2017 real consumer spending growth to 2.5% from 3.1% in the February forecast. And spending growth is lower in each subsequent year, too. So this change is due to IHS's lower expectations for disposable income growth, but it's also due to a change in their expectation for housing demand. So they have long anticipated that young people who are living together and living with their parents through the recession and through a lot of the expansion, that those people would gradually move out and create demand for housing. They still expect that, but they have changed the pace at which they think that's going to happen. So they think that's going to happen a little more slowly, that pent-up housing demand being released. And so slowing down that expectation slowed their expectation for consumer spending on big things like furniture and appliances. And that's one of the things that slowed growth in consumer spending relative to what they had in the prior forecast. And when we do our forecast for Minnesota's sales tax, we look at the forecast for consumer spending and business spending in all of the items that Minnesota taxes. And almost every item that Minnesota taxes, the expectation for consumer spending is slower in this outlook than we had in February. So you'll see that when I talk about the sales tax. But also note that in both of these charts, the GDP chart and the consumer spending chart, growth is still positive. So even though growth is slower than what was expected in February, it's still positive, and so the economy is still growing throughout this throughout our forecast horizon. Key aspects of the U.S. economy remain solid enough for IHS and other forecasters to expect this continued growth throughout our forecast period. Over the next couple of years, IHS expects wage growth to outpace inflation. They also expect that improved employment growth or continued employment growth and improved household balance sheets, those three things, wages, employment, and better household finances, to support consumer spending growth going forward at the rate that they currently forecast. So consumer spending growth will continue to be the largest contributor to real GDP growth going forward in their outlook. So let's move to Minnesota's economy. Well into this long economic expansion, Minnesota continues to add jobs at a fairly steady rate, although the state's employment growth is seeing the effects of drags on exports and a tightening labor market. Consistent job growth has contributed to the state's declining unemployment rate, which is now at 4%. So with strong demand for workers and low unemployment, Minnesota's labor market remains tight. The most recent data indicate that there were as many job seekers as there were unemployed job seekers as there were job vacancies statewide. The number of workers filing initial claims for unemployment insurance has fallen, and the average hourly earnings of private sector employees has also increased. So the chart shows annual growth in total Minnesota wage and salary income. And the way to think about this measure, total wage and salary income, is to imagine adding up all of the payrolls of the entire state of Minnesota. So as long as these numbers are positive, that means that total wage and salary income is growing in Minnesota. So they can move up and down. The rate of change can change, so the pace can change. But as long as they're positive, we're still growing total wage and salary income for the state. Another thing to think about is that that number can grow if we have more people working, or if people are making more money per person, or if both of those things are happening. And in our forecast, both of those things are happening. Another thing to note, so you can see that in our forecast, we are expecting total wage and salary income to grow at a moderate pace of 4.6, so under 5% going forward. The other thing to note about this chart and about the outlook is that the gray and the dark bars are very close together. So that means that there's very little change in our total wage and salary income growth forecast relative to what we had in February. And you'll see that consistency when I talk about the income tax forecast. And remember when I showed the GDP chart and I pointed out that 2016 was a slow growth year for the U.S. economy, you can see a consistency with that in Minnesota's chart, where our total wage and salary income growth was lower this year than it was in 2015, because the state's economy is closely tied to the U.S. economy. When the U.S. slows down a bit, Minnesota is likely to slow down as well.
Excuse me, Dr. Kolumbakidis, I've got a couple of questions. Representative Carlson.
If it's appropriate, now.
Sure, that's fine.
The question I had going back to the Minnesota wage income, keep reading on the business pages, at least, okay, about the labor shortage.
Mm-hmm.
And how statistically does that play into these numbers? Are people picking up more overtime because of the shortage, or are those jobs being outsourced to other places simply because they can't get the workers? I'm just curious how that interplays with mm-hmm. our wage and salary growth.
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson. So a tight labor market, labor shortage, what that means is that we have high demand for labor and we have a slower growing supply of labor than we have demand of labor. So that means, and this is something that we've been talking about for a while and I talked about in the February forecast as well, is that our employment growth, the rate at which we are adding jobs or the rate at which employment is growing in the state, is constrained by slow labor force growth and by the shortage of workers. So, as I said, the going forward in our forecast, this 4.7 or 4.6% annual growth we're expecting, that is composed of both that employment growth and average wages per worker. And so going forward, what we're expecting, because employment growth is relatively constrained, we still have it growing at only about 1% going forward in the outlook, more of that total wage and salary income growth is because of increases in average wages per worker. So what we anticipate is a supply and demand effect, where because the supply of labor is tighter than the demand, average wages per worker should be going up in response. So that means that people looking for jobs may be asking for a higher wage, that employers, in order to find workers, are offering higher wages. It also means when there's a shortage of workers or tight labor market, it means that businesses who are unable to fill positions are thinking, well, what can I do instead of adding more workers? One thing they might do is add new technology. And when you add new technology, you can do the same amount of work with fewer workers, and that increases per worker productivity. When you're producing the same amount of stuff with fewer workers, that increases per worker productivity, which allows those workers to demand higher wages because they're more productive. So that's how this is figuring into our total wage and salary forecast.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor, when you're talking about labor, and to maybe tag on to what Representative Carlson said, maybe you'll get to this, but I'm just wondering if you could expound on the labor participation rate mm-hmm. in the state and how that correlates with the jobs that are being created.
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, members, Minnesota has a very high labor force participation rate relative to other states and relative to the U.S. average, and that has been the case for a very long time. One of the reasons for that is because Minnesota has a very high labor force participation rate by women. So when women entered the workforce in droves in the 60s and 70s, they did that even more so in Minnesota. And so we have a high labor force participation rate relative to other parts of the country. But our labor force participation rate is low relative to our own history, and that's true for other states and for the United States. That labor force participation rate has fallen over time as people have aged out of the workforce. So as the population ages and people age out of the workforce, fewer people who are over age 16 are participating in the labor force. So what that means is that a tight labor market is high demand and tight supply. So we don't want to decrease the demand for workers. That wouldn't be an economic policy goal. But how can we possibly increase the supply of workers in order to relieve some of this pressure of businesses that are looking for employees? So I think that employers are looking for creative ways to do that. So they're looking for possibly raising wages. But another way is to be more flexible in the workplace, in the work environment. So what are ways that they can encourage people who have retired to come back? What are ways that they can look to the pools of unemployed workers that we still have and look to communities that they might not have been familiar with before? What are ways that they can help people move from one part of the state to the other? So those are ways that we can sort of loosen up the supply of labor or be more flexible going forward, and for Minnesota to continue to be a destination of choice for people around the country and around the world who are looking for a place to live and work.
Mr. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor, again, on that point about employment, you mentioned that in the whole we've had an improvement in terms of employment, but I'm wondering if you'd be willing to expand on two points in terms of any sectors of the economy where that employment has seen greater gains mm-hmm. on the net, and maybe somewhere potentially we've seen a reduction or a loss of jobs, but also in terms of geographically where we're finding those new employment opportunities, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, members, regarding industrial sectors, the sectors that are in the negative for year over year, so since the last employment data looking 12 months, how employment has changed, mining and logging and manufacturing and wholesale trade have all reduced employment in the last 12 months. There are a number of things going on there, but I think the thing that ties those together is challenges to exports. So the U.S. dollar has been strong for a long time, for a couple of years, and when the dollar is strong, that makes our exported goods, both commodities and manufactured goods, more expensive overseas. And so that has the firms and the sectors in Minnesota that export their commodities or their manufactured goods have seen a challenge there. And so those sectors have released jobs or reduced jobs. The largest employing sector, super sectors for Minnesota are the education and healthcare services sector, which is both private education, not K-12 education, but private education, and healthcare services. For Minnesota, that's largely healthcare services, about 85% healthcare services. That's been the largest increase in employment year over year for Minnesota. And then the second one is professional and business services. And those are both our largest private employers, those two sectors, and the largest growth in the last couple of years. Regarding geography, most of the job vacancies are in the Twin Cities, but there's a lot of job vacancies spread across the state of Minnesota. And so there are challenges to adding jobs in places where, for instance, where mining and logging is important. That's obviously been a challenge. In places where manufacturing is important, that's been a challenge. And then places that have slower population growth. So the reason for slower labor force growth in Minnesota is because of population growth. And so where you have less population growth, it's harder for businesses to add jobs because they need the people.
Thank you. Dr. Kolumbakidis, one other question here on this. What are you forecasting the unemployment rate in Minnesota to be then, say, over the next 3-4 years? I guess I don't see that in here. Are you expecting it to just kind of stay stable at 4%, or what are you thinking?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we don't have that in our outlook this time. It's not something that we actually use when we forecast revenues, and so we took it out this time. If I remember correctly, it was we had it come getting a little bit lower than what it is now, but not ever getting to the point to the low point of the previous economic expansion, or so to the economic expansion of the 90s. So in the 90s, it got down to, I think, under 3, and we weren't anticipating that.
Okay.
That low.
Representative Carlson.
Just as a follow-up to that, what would we consider full employment?
Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Columbakidis.
Because you're always going to, Mr. Chairman, have a few people that are, for one reason or another, job searching that may not have landed one yet, but we used to use different percentages as a way of defining where we've achieved full employment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members, so full employment at the at a national level doesn't mean every single person is working, because as you said, there's always some amount of people who are moving around, who are changing jobs and looking for jobs. And it's defined at the national level as a level of unemployment at which you would expect wage acceleration to lead to price inflation. It's less well defined at the state level because Minnesota alone isn't going to lead to national price inflation. But you can look at some of the metrics that are used to determine U.S. or to define U.S. full employment and look at how those sort of affect or how those look relative to Minnesota. So at the U.S. level, many observers think that full employment is about 5% of the headline unemployment rate. Minnesota has been below 5% for quite a long time and is at 4% now and has been below 4%. So another way to measure it is to look at a more expanded measure of unemployment, which includes people who are discouraged workers, people who are marginally attached to the workforce, and people who are working part-time but would like to be full-time. And that measure, people say, when that's about 9%, that should be about 9% at full employment. If for Minnesota, it's well below that. It's at eight or so. So by that measure, we're at full employment. Another way to look at it is looking at the number of unemployed workers relative to the number of job vacancies. And in Minnesota, that's just about 1-to-1. It's 1.2. So we have just about the same number of unemployed workers looking for jobs as we have job vacancies. So by any of those measures, Minnesota is at or near approximately its full employment potential. We do think there's still some labor market slack in Minnesota's labor market. There still are some people who can be drawn into the workforce, and obviously there are unemployed workers who want to work, but we're getting close.
Thank Representative you. Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Columbakidis. Happy holidays and Merry Christmas to you. So, Doctor, you talked about the workforce participation rate, and I listened closely there, and I wasn't aware. So are the people who are retired, are they included in the denominator in the calculation for workforce participation rate? I understood it to be the percentage of people who are looking or who want to be employed who are employed. Can you help us with the definition of what that is?
Dr. Columbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the labor force participation rate is the number of people who are of working age, so over 16, who are participating in the labor force, either by working or by looking for work. So if your population is aging so that you have more people who are going to retire, who are of retirement age, that's going to decrease your labor force participation rate.
Representative Druskowski.
So, Mr. Chair and Dr. If you're retired, you aren't looking for work. Is that, I don't know that you're including the denominator at that point.
Dr. Columbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you're right. If you're retired, you're not looking for work, but you're still of that age. So that's one of the things that can be, maybe misleading about looking at the changes in the labor force participation rate, because that number can fall. Your labor force participation rate can fall because people are aging out of the workforce. and that may not be the measure that you want to look at.
So, Representative Kowalski.
So, Mr. Chair and Doctor, thank you. I'll talk to you offline. I'd like to understand that better. But tell us about, I hear a lot, we just went through an election cycle, and I hear from my constituents, the drumbeat and the frustration is greater from people who are either working or looking for work with the numerous and generous welfare and tax programs that provide disincentive for people to work or incentive for people not to work. And I'm hearing this from people more than I ever had in the last 9 years I've served in the legislature. So can a very benevolent government contribute to the workforce participation rate expanding?
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, the ignoring for a moment people who are of retirement age and aren't participating because they're retiring, so looking at labor force participation by people who are below retirement age, there's not a significant, or how shall I put this? For instance, the number of discouraged workers in Minnesota, so the people who have stopped looking for work because they don't think that there's something out there with their qualifications, or the people who are marginally attached to the workforce, which means that they aren't currently looking for work, but they did look for work within the last year, and they're available for work. Looking at those measures, which are two other measures of slack in the labor market, so people who we could pull into the game, right? Those numbers are at pre-recession levels for Minnesota. And so we don't have as much slack in our labor market as the U.S. does. So when the Fed is thinking about what they're going to do next and they're looking at possible improvements to the labor market, there's more slack at the U.S. level than there is at the Minnesota level. So the kinds of things that can improve labor force participation among people who are not of retirement or even of retirement age, I think the economy is naturally going to do this. And it's in our forecast that we expect average wages to grow. And so that's going to make whatever the alternative is for people, whatever the thing is that's keeping them from looking for work or from working, it's going to look better to work because wages are going up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor.
Members, at this time I'm going to officially convene the meeting because we do have a quorum. And members, I would remind you, I think most of you have already seen it, but we do have the per diem and mileage reimbursement sheets over there by the folder. So if you haven't gotten one of those, please feel free to get one when you leave so you can turn those in and get that if you're interested in that. Dr. Kolumbakidis, please proceed.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, so our revenue forecast is on the next table. On the left is our new forecast for the current biennium, along with the dollar amount changes from the prior estimate. And on the right is the new forecast for the next biennium and our dollar amount changes from the prior estimate. Total general fund revenues for the current biennium are now forecast to be $41 million more than the prior estimate. Higher expected corporate, statewide property and other tax revenues or other revenues offset lower forecasts for individual income and sales tax revenues. For the next biennium, the current forecast is for revenues to be $467 million less than what we had previously estimated or forecast, and the forecast change is due to lower expected individual income and sales tax revenues. As you saw before, our wage and salary income forecast changed very little since February. So the relatively small changes in the income tax forecasts for both biennia are due to reductions in growth rates for non-wage income, such as dividend and interest income. We lowered our forecast for sales tax receipts by $107 million in the current biennium and $428 million in the next biennium, consistent with the reduced forecast for U.S. consumer spending that you saw in the earlier chart, and with current fiscal year sales tax collections that have been lower than expected. On the next slide,
Dr. Kolumbakidis, before you get on with that, isn't there a part of that sales tax that's affected by the capital equipment exemption too? I don't know if you want to elaborate on that. And also, it does seem a little bit striking that we've got such a large percentage reduction in the sales tax collections and almost, you know, no reduction in the income tax collections. Can you talk a little bit more about that, too?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, The sales tax reduction in both cases, but let's focus on the current biennium because it's a larger change, was both a change in the forecast or a reduction in the forecast for gross sales tax receipts and for an increase in the forecast for sales tax refunds. The equipment change that Representative Knobloch is talking about is a change that Minnesota enacted from when businesses purchase capital equipment for particular types of uses, that's exempt from tax, and that used to be you would get a refund. So you'd apply for a refund and get that money refunded. And that was changed to an upfront exemption. So you aren't supposed to pay tax at the time that you buy the stuff rather than getting a refund. But businesses had a number of years to apply for those refunds. If they had held on to some refunds, so they bought some equipment, they knew they were due a refund, they hadn't applied for it yet, they got to wait a few years if they wanted to get that refund. And so the forecast for sales tax refunds has been, I would say, obfuscated by that, because it wasn't clear. At first, we would assume that people would do that really quickly. Like, let me get my money back up front or as quickly as possible. But it seems like those refunds are still trickling in. So it's sort of what's left in the pipeline to get a refund. So that's part of the reason for that change. And I think the easiest way to think about these two changes, a relatively small change in the income tax and a relatively larger change in the sales tax, is to just think about those two charts that I put up, where the consumer spending forecast at the U.S. level changed quite a bit from February to November. And our wage forecast, which makes up most of our income tax, but not all of it, of course, changed very little. And a way to think about that is that we have Minnesota-specific information about total wages and salary income. We have less specific information about consumer spending in particular types of items in the state of Minnesota, and so we rely a little more on what the U.S. forecasters say about expected changes in consumer spending.
Thank you. Oh, Representative Albright.
So, Professor Kalambakidis, to that point, would it be fair to say that the variance on your estimate for general sales tax is going to be greater over the next 54 months, to the Commissioner's point about the forecast, than would, say, the change in your individual income tax?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, members, so a variance, I think of a variance, and maybe you can correct me if you're thinking of something else, but I think of variance as the difference between actual collections and what we had forecast. Okay. So at the moment, this is our best forecast. So I would guess the variance is zero, going to be zero going forward. But I would also guess that because they're one of the things that's moving the sales tax forecast is this behavior change on the part of businesses in particular about when they're going to take those refunds. Then whenever there's taxpayer behavior change that we have to guess about or forecast on, we can be surprised. We see that a lot in the income tax on, you know, are taxpayers going to realize capital gains now versus later. So there's risk in this forecast. I think that number, you know, has, as I said, that change, law change obscured our understanding of the sales tax, which should be relatively stable.
So as we would look to the February forecast, which we would base our budget numbers on, what degree of confidence or in the variance or that those two outliers should we place on consideration of the various budgets that we're thinking about?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, members of the committee. Well, in a moment, I'll outline some of the risks inherent in this entire forecast. So I think that there's at least as much risk in this forecast as there usually is in a November forecast. And so at the moment, these are our best estimates for what we think is going to happen going forward. We'll incorporate every piece of information we have between now and February for the next forecast. So will these numbers change in February? Yes, they will. I can't at the moment predict whether they'll change a lot or a little.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, a question. You may not have the answer to this, but earlier when you were talking about consumer behavior and the sales tax, you referenced housing as being such a key and the other goods that go into purchasing a house. And as we were talking about the sales tax, I began to think about, well, where is that income going? We were just talking about the fact that Minnesota, depending on how you define it, is reaching full employment. So assuming a lot of these people that are not organizing households are working, are they putting that money into savings? Are they purchasing, and then it gets to the sales tax, other consumer goods that would be under the jurisdiction of the sales tax payment? There has to be some shift in the economy and where that money is being housed or spent.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, by simple algebra, you are right that if, you know, what you do with your income is either spend it or save it. And so if we think that there are that consumers are expected to slow down their spending relative to what we had thought prior, then they maybe they're saving more or paying down debt, which is a form of saving. So you're right in terms of spending. If they're not, maybe they're spending more on things that are not taxable in Minnesota.
Yeah,
that's possible too.
Mr. Chairman, the point I was trying to make, if they're spending, then that necessarily isn't going to be a negative on the sales tax, assuming that the goods that they're spending on would be subject to the tax. It may be soft goods that, you know, as opposed to what I would call hard goods, which you've mentioned, stoves, refrigerators, and other furnishings that would go into a house. But thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, Dr. Columbakidis.
So on the next slide, I list more of the risks. You heard from the commissioner about the length of time that we're forecasting out here, so that's a risk in and of itself. But I also talked about the long, slow growth expansion and the vulnerability of the economy in that environment. So even aside from the political uncertainty that I talked about, these are risks that would have felt embedded in this forecast. But we do have significant U.S. policy uncertainty about fiscal policy, trade, immigration, and regulatory policy. And hopefully that will be clarified in coming months. I haven't talked about inflation much here, but inflation has begun to grow. And in this forecast, it is expected to gradually build up from the very low historical rates up to in the 2.5% range. So that's in itself isn't a risk to the forecast because that's embedded in the forecast. But the risk is that something happens to make inflation grow faster than that, and for inflation to accelerate beyond the range that feels appropriate for the Fed. And so the risk is that inflation increases faster than the Fed is comfortable with, and then the Fed acts to slow down inflation, which would slow down the economy. International trade, I talked about some of the sectors that have been affected by international trade in Minnesota, manufacturers, farmers, people producing natural resource commodities, and slow global growth. A pickup in global growth is embedded in this forecast. But there's significant uncertainty both about the rate of global growth and about trade policy, U.S. trade policy. And finally, the biennium that you're about to budget for, we haven't collected any of those revenues yet, and so there's risk associated with all of those. So if there's no more questions, I'll pass it on to Budget Director Kelly.
Dr. Kelly. Budget Director Kelly.
Oh, doctor.
She's earned it.
I'm going to walk through the expenditure changes in this forecast and then through the overall changes in the budget and the impact on the bottom line. So overall, spending is reduced in both the current and the next biennium compared to previous forecasts. And you can see some of the major categories of spending here, comparing, showing our November forecast amounts for the current biennium, 16-17. And the next biennium, 18-19, and showing what the dollar change is compared to our previous forecast. Clearly, you can see on this table that health and human services spending is driving the savings. And if we start at the top of the table, Education spending is virtually unchanged from the end of session estimates, only a $3 million change on a $17 billion budget. We're seeing faster growth rate in the number of students, resulting in additional general education spending, but again, it's really a minor change. Property tax aids and credits are also relatively unchanged from end of session estimates, with minor fluctuations in the number and the average size of property tax refunds. Health and Human Services spending changes are almost entirely health care related and are the result of two trends. First, lower enrollment in basic health care services. This is in all category, major enrollment categories, families with children, adults without children, and elderly and disabled adults. And in that latter category, the lower projection is coming from disabled adults. We're actually estimating growth in enrollment in elderly population, and we're seeing that baby boom generation coming onto our programs a little earlier than we had anticipated. Overall, enrollment in our healthcare programs is growing just at a slower rate. Second, we're seeing lower average payments for some home and community-based services, and these are services that are designed to help the elderly and the disabled stay living in the community longer. And this change is largely due to an influx of healthier individuals in our Community Access Disability Inclusion, or CADI, waiver. When the caps were lifted last session, healthier individuals came into the program, bringing the overall payment rate down. Moving on, debt service expenditures are lower in the current biennium. The bond sale that we held in August was a little bit smaller than we had originally anticipated, and the interest rates were much better than we had anticipated. So overall, the costs for that bond sale are lower going into the future. But in the next biennium, we're now assuming an $800 million bonding bill next session. We typically assume a smaller bonding bill in the odd legislative year, but given that there was no bonding bill last year, we thought it prudent to assume a larger bonding bill this coming legislative session. So how do these spending changes and revenue changes that Dr. Kolumbakidis talked about impact our bottom line? On this table, you can see for the current biennium, the 16-17 biennium, we were anticipating a $729 million balance at the end of the legislative session. And since then, we have officially closed our books on fiscal year 16. We ended that fiscal year ahead of projections. The gain we saw in fiscal year 16 is offset by the lowered revenue projections for fiscal 17 that Dr. Kolumbakidis spoke to, resulting in a small fiscal year or a small $41 million revenue gain in this forecast. Spending is also lowered in the current biennium, $245 million, which brings us to a positive balance of $1.012 billion. And current law allocates 33% of the November forecast balance to the budget reserve, so we put $334 million into the budget reserve, leaving $678 million on the bottom line, just $51 million less than we had anticipated at the end of session. And that contributes to our balance in the next biennium, fiscal year 18-19. We're now estimating a $1.4 billion balance, which is a bit smaller than we were anticipating at the end of legislative session. $467 million fewer resources, offset by $152 million of lower spending, leaving us with $376 million less than we were projecting at the end of session. And this is what will set the stage for the governor's budget development that will be revised in February for the budget that the legislature ultimately passes. So as we look ahead, this is the first time we are forecasting revenue and expenditure projections for fiscal years 20 and 21. The table here compares the revenues that are collected within the biennium to the spending obligations that we're projecting within that same biennium. And you can see we're projecting a positive balance in both biennia, with revenues growing at an average annual rate of 3.5% compared to spending growing at an average annual rate of 2.7%. That's fiscal year 18 to fiscal year 21. And finally, we don't include inflation in the forecast, except there are a few areas of spending where inflation is allowed per statute. The estimates, as Dr. Kolumbakidis mentioned, are higher in this forecast, 2.4% to 2.6%, compared to much lower estimates in previous forecasts when we were in the 1.2 to 1.8% range. So clearly that has an impact on agency abilities to manage and maintain current services.
Budget Director Kelly, I think this is one thing you've changed since the last time you did forecasts, is you used to just take the spending and apply the inflation rate to it without subtracting things like debt service or special education that you either we have an automatic inflator built in or, you know, with debt service it's sort of a fixed number. Can you tell us what these numbers would have been if we had left it the old way or, I mean, just roughly, or can you tell us, I mean, are these, you know, 25% lower roughly? Give us sort of a ballpark range of how they've changed by this change in doing this.
Mr. Chair, you're correct that we tried as much as we could to refine this estimate modestly. Like you said, in the past, we simply applied the inflation factor against all spending, which overestimated inflation. Now we've pulled out those things that have an inflating factor in them. If you give me a minute, I can find about how much. It's about $5 to $6 million, $4 million that we've pulled out of spending. So $4 million on $20 million, that's less than 20%.
$4 million on $20 million. I'm not sure if I follow what you mean.
Per year. I'm sorry.
That you took out of the
you didn't apply base. Inflation to. Right, that we didn't apply inflation to. So that'd be $8 million out of the projected spending of $44 million.
$44 billion. Okay. Okay.
Billion,
so it's
correct.
So you said it's seven. It's $4 to $5 billion per year. Is that what you said?
Correct. That we've pulled out.
Okay. So the $8 to $10 billion. So okay. So like maybe in the range of 20%. Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Carlson, did you have a question?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chairman. I on the revenue side. I was going to ask now, you're building all this on current law, and yet there's talk of a special session and the passage of a tax bill. And are you calculating anything at all, any projections when you get to the out biennium as to what the changes would be if something close to the current bill that's on the table is passed into law?
Budget Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is a current law forecast, so it hasn't taken into account the possibility of any other change.
So even in the out biennium, you don't make any speculation about how things might change. I know they're in the process of recalculating the cost of that bill, but I was just curious when you're dealing with the forecast how you handle that. So this could change rather dramatically then with the passage of the tax bill. The point I wanted to make, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Director Kelly, do you have any sense for, I mean, in terms of the tax bill, would it change much? Is it anticipated to change much if we did repass it today in terms of its cost?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I'm not going to speculate on that. The Department of Revenue is doing that estimating. We should know sometime early next week.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, could I?
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Carlson.
If there is a special session, will this committee convene for any discussions on some of those relevant issues prior to the special session, or recess after we convene to have a committee meeting? Maybe that's getting too far down the road, but they are talking about the 20th as a potential.
Yeah, you know, Representative date. Carlson. Yeah. I guess I'd have to say I don't know that I can tell you that. They haven't even decided yet if there is going to be one. I know I've heard talk about the 20th. I was in here and had some discussions on Friday. As far as I know, nothing's been finalized yet. As you know, sometimes there is an agreement to have some committee hearings. Sometimes there's an agreement to just suspend the rules on everything. And since there is no final agreement yet, I guess I don't have an answer.
I was just wondering if you were aware of any plans of this at this point. The other relevant committee with the question I was raising, of course, would be the tax committee and whether they would be convening or whether it would be just this committee. But my point is that at some point there would need to be, I would assume, a discussion in some forum how it may change relative to this committee the future forecast if that's passed into law.
I mean, I would say, Representative Carlson, that if we are simply going back and passing bills that we've already voted on in this committee and there's no substantive change to those, there's probably less need for us to meet than underneath some other circumstances. But I really don't know anything yet in terms of whether there's going to be one and what the format might be for scheduling.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I was referring to was, which I think is relevant, is how these numbers would change, because these are all projected, as I initially pointed out in my opening comment, based on current law. And then that would change, and that would change the forecast rather dramatically. Maybe we won't see it until the February forecast. I don't know quite how that works, but that's going to be part of our decision making, maybe in a few days, it does have relevancy to these numbers potentially at some point.
It certainly does, and since the tax chair isn't here, I'll say for him, don't stop believing.
Mr. Chair, members, we're really, that's our completes our presentation. We're happy to take more questions, but thank you.
Okay, Representative Keene.
Speaker and Director Kelly, I'm just looking at the Healthcare Access Fund revenues and the 2% provider tax, which is slated to go away. Two questions. Number one, in fiscal year 20, it goes from about $700,694,000,000 down to $490,000,000. I forgot why that does that. And then the second question was that your long-term budget outlook remaining stable and the forecasted revenues growing at structural balance anticipates the elimination of the provider tax. And would that be in half of the 2021 biennium, or how does that factor in?
First of all, Budget Director Kelly, I do want to alert people to the fact that there is a handout about Healthcare Access Fund balances in your packet. Budget Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, you're speaking to this slide here, correct? Your second question? Or are you just speaking to the Healthcare Access Fund?
Just generally the Healthcare Access Fund. I was looking at a different spreadsheet, but that's fine.
Right. The Healthcare Access Fund, the provider tax, goes away. It sunsets December 31st of 2019. So that's halfway through fiscal year 20. So we see revenues begin to decline in fiscal year 20 and zero out in fiscal year 21. And so the positive balance that we're showing in the Healthcare Access Fund in fiscal year 21 assumes that the spending continues and assumes that the revenues zero out, you know, start to diminish in fiscal year 20 and zero out in fiscal year 21. So there's sufficient balance in that fund to continue paying for the health care programs through the end of this 21 biennium.
Representative Dean.
And Director Kelly, so there would not be an anticipated reduction in the 2% provider tax to decrease down to 1.5% based on accumulated revenues within this forecast?
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I'm not sure we've completed that analysis.
Right. And just lastly, obviously, if we use those resources for something else, obviously they would not be sufficient funds within that. And if we had a reduction, say, for example, in federal Medicaid funding, then we would have to rely on those funds for that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, correct. To the extent we use the Healthcare Access Fund for other purposes, that diminishes the balance available for the Minnesota Care Program. to the extent that there are changes at the federal level in Medicaid or in the Affordable Care Act, that will change federal revenues coming to the state and our ability to maintain that program.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Franz, when I was on my way over here, listening to the radio, there was a report about General Mills, and it is restructuring and laying off a fair number of people. And I think we shouldn't find that as a surprise. General Mills has been under stress, and we've been reading about it a lot because consumers are changing their desires to have more natural foods and less processed foods. So our administration, or your administration, does help the farm community to its credit. Do you anticipate, or can we trust that you will be helping those farmers who would be supplying General Mills to help General Mills out this time?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, you know, it's interesting when you start pulling apart some of these different scenarios that can occur out there, and I know that Professor Columbakidis and her team do a great job of trying to factor in what's going on in the different sectors and the different industries, but there are always these little bumps occur. You can never anticipate all these little bumps, and then the ramifications, what happens, even if General Mills has these reorganizations, it does have these other effects throughout the economy. And clearly one of the things we'll be looking to see is what changes are their contracts, you know, with commodity suppliers in the state of Minnesota. To what extent are those suppliers at risk given a reduction in demand by you know, General Mills? But, you know, there are a lot of our ag industry supplies to a lot of different different manufacturers. So we'll look at that, but we'll have to see what it does specifically with the Minnesota growers.
If I could follow up.
Representative Guineas.
I think I wasn't articulating my question very well. Lay out the problem, but General Mills is asking for a different kind of commodity to satisfy its consumer. And that's where I am asking, if the administration is going to help General Mills out so that commodity comes from Minnesota and not California or Wisconsin or wherever. So that's getting more to my point.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonneau, I appreciate that. I think one of the things we, in a number of different areas, the legislature and the governor have agreed to really require the use of Minnesota-grown not just commodities, but steel, for example. And I think that's always something we'll have to look at. I mean, that is, it's always difficult. You have to be careful of the unintended consequences. But I can let Professor Columbakidis talk more about market forces, but something we'll look at.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, there are other ways to help out General Mills and the rest of us, other than just saying Minnesota grown. We do help other farmers, and perhaps we need to look at helping those farmers who are going to be the suppliers of General Mills. So looking at it just almost the opposite, not a saying you must, but helping out folks who could supply General Mills from Minnesota rather than from someplace else. Am I making myself clear?
Yes.
Okay.
I guess I don't see any other questions at the moment, so I've got some questions. If I can go to page 8, I want to focus in on Health and Human Services. We've got a pretty large projected increase in Health and Human Services funding here, very large, from $11.8 billion in 16 and 17 to $14.3 billion rounded in 18 and 19. I know some of this is a timing change, but can you kind of deconstruct this and say how much of this is a timing change and how much of it is a real increase and what is driving that?
Mr. Chair, about $530 million of expenditures in fiscal year 18-19 were expenditures that actually occurred in fiscal year 16-17 but were not reflected on the general fund. And so we don't really have an apples-to-apples comparison here in this table. So those were expenditures, Medicaid expenditures in 16 and 17 that were shifted to the healthcare access fund, and payments to healthcare providers that were delayed between fiscal years and they were pushed out into the 18-19 biennium. So when you account for that, the percentage change, prior to that, the percentage change is about a 20% growth in spending. When you account for those changes, it's about a 14% growth in spending.
Okay, and 14% is still a lot. Can you talk a little bit about what is driving that?
Mr. Chair, it's both enrollment and the cost of care.
And can you be a little bit more specific? I mean, is that mostly medical assistance, or is it kind of across the board everything?
Mr. Chair, it's primarily in the healthcare area, and so the elderly and disabled are about 25% of our enrollment, yet they represent about 75% of our program costs, and that population is growing.
Okay. And maybe I'll ask this question maybe for the commissioner. So where are we in terms of the total budget reserve balance right now, and how much more would we need before we were completely full in terms of what we had wanted to allocate underneath the statute we've got? Or Dr. Columbakidis, maybe?
Mr. Chair, so we are now a little over $1.9 billion. I think we have the exact numbers in the book here. We'll get them for you. We need about $150 million more to get to the target. The target's a little over $2.77 billion or something like that. So we're about $150 million just shy of the actual target. So we have $1.93 billion now in the reserve as of last Friday.
Okay. And refresh my memory in terms of the way the target is calculated. It's 4.9% of some spending number, right?
Yeah.
Dr. Columbakidis?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It's 4.9% of net non-dedicated revenues.
Okay.
Net non-dedicated general fund revenues.
And is that a statutory number, or is that just a number that you've come up with? I mean, I shouldn't say it that way. I mean, I'm not trying to cast aspersion on the number. I'm just trying to say, I mean, if we decided for some reason that that number should be different, does that take a statutory change? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the statute says that MMB will analyze revenue volatility and changes in revenue volatility, and based on that, determine what the percentage of net non-dedicated general fund revenues should be. So the number, the 4.9%, isn't in statute. But every year we are required to evaluate it and set that percentage. So the budget reserve, we set the percentage based on our analysis of revenue volatility, and that means that the target amount in the budget reserve floats with the amount of revenues, and then once a year that might move, the target, the percentage might move if we see changes in the, you know, structural economy or the tax system.
Representative Oguinius.
Yes, it's just a follow-up to see if I understand this correctly. So if it's based on volatility and we are seeing that the economy is more susceptible or more vulnerable right now, will you have for us in February where we can see how vulnerable we are, mm-hmm. will you have a new number for us in February based on, what you're seeing in February? Because I think what I heard you say before is you'll have a much better idea of the volatility in February than you have now. Am I getting that right?
Dr. Columbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, there are a couple of things that will happen between now and February. One is that you will get a new forecast, and so that denominator will change. and the 4.9% stays the same. So the target will, the target is actually set only once a year. We release our revenue volatility report on September 30th. So that's when we set the percentage. And so it is not the case that information that comes in between now and February will change that 4.9%. We only do that once a year. And that the percentage shouldn't change that much because it changes based on changes in the economy. So if there are things like if income becomes more volatile because capital gains becomes more volatile because the stock market is more volatile, we'll assess that. And it'll also it can also change if the structure of the tax system changes. So we're looking at all the different types of taxes or the major types of taxes and their relative volatility and then how they interact with one another. So if there's a significant tax law change that changes the how much we're relying on different types of taxes, that will change that percent, that 4.9%. So that percentage will not change between now and February, but it could change by September 30th of next year.
Representative Pagenius.
But the percentage won't change. Will the dollar amount change based on the new forecast?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wiginius, the dollar amount of the target is the percentage times net forecast net general fund revenues for the current biennium. So that base, that denominator number will change, so then the target changes.
Okay. So
Representative Wiginius.
It troubles me a bit that the 4.9 was set in September when folks were not seeing as much volatility as I think could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so keeping that in mind as we do our reserves seems important to me because that there could be substantially more volatility when we get to February, or we can see substantially more volatility in February than we saw in September.
Representative McNamara, welcome to the committee.
Well, welcome.
Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Mr. Chair, and I'm at ease today knowing that you're still going to be here, so glad to hear that. I don't know if that's inappropriate, but I don't care. I do actually have a question. Commissioner, how is the $1.93 billion reserve invested, and is that in statute how it should be invested?
Mr.
Friend.
Chair, Representative, all investments that occur on behalf of the state are through the State Board of Investment. And so to the extent we have what we call kind of short-term or available cash, the SBI manages that on our behalf. And so obviously they manage a lot of different funds, the pension funds and available cash funds. So this is part of the, to the extent that we have, as you know, the cash account of $350 million that we access to use to run the daily operations of the government. And even the cash there, if it exceeds a certain amount, is managed by the SBI. But this amount is typically managed by the SBI. I'm not sure. It must be in statute, but I don't know where it is. I'll have to look. I'll get back to you on that.
Just stumping them to the end, Representative McNamara.
No, I'm just curious. So it's invested. It does not have a specific investment strategy, and that's never been in statute. It's just interesting because this money, if it's needed, will be needed when there's a downturn in the economy, which probably would also mean that the market is downturned. And I was wondering, I get in the long term, it would grow faster being invested by, and I will say they do a great job. When I compare it with all the other things that I've got going on, I'm still glad that I've got them investing my state money. But is it just invested as part of the general investment strategy of theirs? Is that what you're telling me, Commissioner?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. One of the things that they do, I mean, they obviously have to manage some assets to be more readily available than others. And this is one of those funds that they have to make sure that they can access if, in fact, there's a downturn fairly quickly. So they have different management decisions that they make based on how long they think they can hold the money, and then short-term money. So they apply their different standards. No, I think they do an excellent job as well at the State Board of Investment. But I'm sure Mr. Perry would be happy to describe that to you in more detail.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Commissioner, if you could get back to the chairman, just I'm curious to know, I think you're saying it does not have a specific strategy, that it is part of the bigger picture investment, which seems like that is that the most prudent one, where I realize for long term, I guess it would be tied to how long do we think it's going to be before we need it. And if we knew that, we wouldn't be sitting where we are. So I guess I'm curious to know that, and I'm assuming it, then it's not specified in statute that it should be invested a certain way.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's true, but I'll verify that for you.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Commissioner.
Representative Kahn.
I just wanted to point out, anyone who's too proud about the state of Minnesota's State Board of Investment, that another group that I follow, the Yale University's investment policy return, is three times better than the state of Minnesota. So there are better models out there than what we currently do.
Is it still three times better this
yes,
year, Representative Kahn?
So. That was pretty recent.
All right. Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. An interesting topic, and we have had this discussion before as part of it, but, you know, we have successive now years, many of them, I don't know, four, five, six successive years of setting all-time record highs in the amount of the people's money they were accumulating in the budget reserve of state government. And now we hear today, then I guess I should have been aware of this, but I was not, that government has the ability to keep even more of it granted to it by the past legislatures and governor. So I'm curious, is this only a one-way check valve, or is there the ability for those numbers to ever go backwards and collect less of the people's money, or under a certain scenario for the government to actually give more of that over $2 billion back when you add those two numbers up?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Well, actually, 6 years ago, I remember at this time, 6 years ago, the deficit was $6 billion. And in the February forecast of 2011, it went down to $5.2 billion. In fact, I recall the moment that the governor had offered me the job as a revenue commissioner. I went home proudly to say that I've been offered the job. And my wife smiled and said, well, that's nice. How are you going to come up with $6 billion? Kind of took the wind out of my sails for a little bit. The point being that these things change a lot. And yes, we'd like to get it right on the money, but I think when you look at the one number where the income tax revenue was projected within a few million dollars out of several billion dollars, it's really difficult to fine-tune these adjustments to these forecasts to the extent you can hit it right on the money. I mean, the legislature and the governor have the right to do whatever they want with the revenue stream and the spending that they have here. I would simply just urge caution. Clearly, the decision to have a reserve fund was decided by the legislature and the governor and has been in effect now since 2014. And the rating agencies, I'm firmly convinced that one of the reasons the rating agency increased our rating back to AAA this last summer was, in fact, part of our reserve fund. The Pew Research Center talks about the way that we do this reserve funding, the way that we set it up and manage it, is really a model for other states to follow. We just don't know when downturns are going to occur, Representative, and I think it's incumbent upon us to be ready for that. And I think one of the ways that the Budget Trend Study Committee back in 2008 studied the volatility of revenue streams and what to do to try to protect for that downturn in the economy, and they reached the conclusion, although there's some other things you can do, that they thought the most prudent was to have a reserve account to be ready for that. And this reserve account is set up to be ready to withstand a 95% of
So 95% of the time it'll cover deficit generated by revenue volatility.
95% of the time it'll cover a deficit generated by revenue volatility. So I guess I would just urge caution in terms of going forward and making too many changes. We have structural balance now. And I would simply urge caution to make sure that whatever levers we all agree to pull in the future, that they pull levers in a way that we maintain structural balance. I think businesses prefer that the state of Minnesota have a stable budget, that we invest in education, we invest in training, So there are a lot of good reasons that we're maintaining this balance. You know, if we had everything solved, if we had all the bridges fixed, the roads fixed, the schools redone, and the water all clean, then that's a different scenario. But we have some things from my point of view and the governor's point of view that we still need to do with this balance.
Representative Gostkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. You know, I think we all agree that we need to have structural balance and structural integrity to our budget. However, not only is our budget reserve continuing to increase in its size, taking more and more of the extra money that's being over-collected here from the hardworking people of the state of Minnesota and placing it into the government's reserves, if you will, but we still have yet a structural surplus in place. We are over-collecting the people's money. We have been for 2 or 3 years now, and we're projected, according to this outlook, to over-collect it to the point of $1.4 billion at one point and even $3 or $4 billion as we get several years down the road. That's taking more and more of the people's money. So I think we agree. We need to fix the structural problems, and we certainly need to take a look at the over-collection of people's money as well. So I thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a comment and a follow-up on that, and I'm not sure I want to get into a heavy debate, but back when Governor Cui was in office, I carried some of the budget balancing bills. In fact, the mega one at one point. And when Governor Cui campaigned for office successfully, he used an argument very similar to what you just heard from Representative Gostkowski. And he was very successful in reducing the amount that went into the budget reserve. Well, then what wasn't planned for was that the national economy really began to slide. And some of you may remember that. What that meant for Minnesota, we had 6, I think, or maybe 7 special sessions because we were continually, when I say I carried some of those bills, balancing the budget. Well, when Governor Cui left office, and I'm paraphrasing what he said, but basically he said, or was asked by the media, what he would have done differently. And he said, I would have had a larger budget reserve. He learned from that experience that he had as governor. So you have to be a little bit careful in terms of what you maintain for a budget reserve, because you never know when we might have difficulties like that. And that those budget years, it was unraveling so fast that we would meet, we would negotiate a budget balancing bill, and the fiscal analysts that worked with me and worked in that department said, at the time, Lynn, we're going to be back next month. You know, it's just, that's how fast things were going down. And we didn't have the reserves to back it up. And so that meant some short-term borrowing and so on. And for the time, if you keep in mind when that was, when I say I had the mega one, that was about $1 billion in some tax increases, heavily in cuts. But at any rate, I just put that out there as a bit of a warning that, you know, and we can talk for a long period of time as to what the size of that budget reserve would be made or should be. But 6 years ago, the decision was to benchmark it toward what our goal is now, which is roughly $2 billion, if I recall. Again, I was involved with some of those discussions when we did that at that period of time as well. But I just would exercise some caution if we want to greatly reduce that budget reserve, because the other thing has been pointed out here today, the long period of prosperity we've had and just how much longer that can continue. And then we have a new administration coming in, that there may be just huge changes in economic policy. None of us sitting here at the table know what all of that will mean in the end relative to how we're trying to project a future budget out, what, 52 months, I think you said the other day? So I'll just stop there, but thank you.
On this subject, I'm sure, Dr. Kalambakidis, that you knew I was going to ask this question. On this subject of forecast error, we did have some language in the supplemental budget bill that has the state economist and her staff coming up with some new projections on potential, I hesitate to call it forecast error because it's impossible to project these things perfectly, but looking back over history and then looking at if things went well, better than expected, or not as well as expected, how we might expect the forecast to have variance. And I know that your staff is in the process of calculating and putting together a report that we're going to get on that. When do we get that report? I know it's like a few weeks after the budget forecast, but can you tell us that? Dr. Palombakidis?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My recollection of the statute is that that report is due 2 weeks after the release of the budget forecast, and that's what we're aiming for. It's a new report. We've never done it before, and we are just now turning to that, because all of our efforts were on the economic and revenue forecast.
Sure.
What I anticipate providing is, as you say, Chairman, is looking at the history of our forecasts relative to how the biennium ended up. And so I don't like calling it an error either, but the difference between what we forecast and what we ended up with, and looking at how that happened over time. And so statistically, you can look at what's the likely outcome, or so what's the range of outcomes for this forecast, given what the history has been. And so when we release a forecast, we can the economy can change and will change in ways that we hadn't anticipated. And even if we could forecast the economy perfectly, we would not be able to forecast revenues perfectly, because there are imperfections in the way that we model taxpayer behavior, for instance, which I talked about. So that report is going to give you an idea of how we have done in the past, our forecast relative to how a biennium ended up, and then given that information, what's the statistical range that we could end up with. And one just quick clarification about the budget reserve calculation that is based on revenue volatility, that is just based on revenue volatility and on the possibility of a deficit generated by revenue volatility. But if the economy turns down, there will be impacts on the spending side too, and demand for for government services goes up in a downturn, and that's not something that is considered in the calculation for the budget reserve size. So it's an additional source of risk.
Okay, well, members, I would expect that, you know, perhaps at our first meeting or our second meeting after we reconvene here in January, we'll be reviewing that report. And certainly once I get it, we can forward it out to people as well. Another question that I have, seeing the fairly substantial decline in sales tax receipts or projected receipts, I guess I forget how much money was left over in the legacy funds at the end of session. Are we impacting that at all? Do we have enough money in those funds? I guess I forget what we had left over as a cushion in the legacy account.
Mr. Chair, our cushion in the legacy funds was relatively small, and we should have our projections of how the sales tax forecast will impact those funds come this Friday.
All right. Do you recall how much of a balance we did have?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't. But it was, I think, under the 1% range, maybe 2%.
And is that part of are you getting the consolidated financial statement or a consolidated fund statement? Is that going to be out this Friday then? Is that what you're telling me?
Mr. Chair, correct, give or take a day. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other questions from any other members? Otherwise, I do, I would anticipate that most of the returning members, if not all, will probably be on the committee again, but I do in particular want to thank Representative Hackbarth and Representative Kahn, and I don't see Representative McNamara here at the moment. There he is. I want to thank you all for your years of service on the committee and your years in the legislature, and perhaps on December 20th you'll have a chance to speak to the assembled House of Representatives, but if you want to say anything here now, I'm certainly open to it too. Otherwise, thank you very much for your service. We will certainly miss you. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Dr. Kolumbakidis, Commissioner France, Budget Director Kelly. Happy holidays and Merry Christmas to everyone. The meeting is adjourned.